Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Ellen Stofan, NASA's chief scientist. Given the efforts surrounding NASA science, I think you may have said maybe a year ago or so something akin to this, but should we have definitive evidence of life outside of the Earth in 20 or 30 years? How will we obtain such evidence? And should we expect future missions to have more instrumentation designed specifically for detecting life?
Yeah, I got myself in a bit of trouble by making this prediction, but I actually feel extremely comfortable. You know, it was at the end of a press conference, and the guy asked us to, Dwayne Brown asked us to speculate on when we thought we'd find life. And the guy next to me said, oh, I think we'll find it before I retire. And I kind of looked at him and figured, well, he just said that. I'll say the same thing, except I'll actually put years on it, but I'm sorry to force him into retirement. But I said I thought we would find strong indications of life within 10 years. Mm-hmm. And definitive evidence within 20 to 30. And so what I meant by that is even right now, for example, on Mars, we have an instrument on Mars right now that's finding fragments of organic molecules. The problem on Mars is it doesn't have a magnetic field. So you have incoming radiation, which basically breaks up organic molecules. So if you can think of a surface of a planet where every once in a while you've got a little fragment. Now, our tough job at the moment is to look at all these little fragments and say, are these just sort of random molecules that maybe were brought here by meteorites, or are they indications of past or current life on Mars? And we just don't know because we don't have enough information. So we're already finding what I would say intriguing things on Mars, but it's not enough of a story to let us say this is even a strong indication of life. We're just not there yet. But our curiosity is still roving across Mars. The Europeans have a rover going to Mars called ExoMars that's looking for signs of life. We have a rover in 2020 called the 2020 rover that's looking for signs of life. And given that's the goal of those upcoming rovers, I'm pretty optimistic that one of them is going to find something. And that's my indication. But it's more going to be, have we found a bigger fragment? Have we found some gases? Have we found something? So it's not something that the whole scientific community would, you know, break open the champagne. Advancing towards that. I think my big hope is that astronaut, frankly, on the surface, cracking open the rock, and frankly, with a laboratory, because it's not just going to be cracking open one rock. It's going to be breaking open a lot. It's going to be looking at a lot of samples. That's really going to get us that definitive evidence that life evolved. In the meantime, we're also studying Europa, this moon of Jupiter that's got this icy crust underneath it is a liquid water ocean. We're sending a spacecraft there in the early 2020s. We'd like to get back to Titan. It's got these mysterious seas of organic. It's very cold on Titan, no liquid water. But you've got this very interesting environment that could you get life or not? That's pushing the envelope of environments in which we think life could evolve. Another moon of Saturn called Enceladus that has, again, a subsurface liquid water ocean. Enceladus spits out that ocean in plumes that we've already flown through from Cassini, and we could go back with that more sophisticated instrumentation that you're talking about. So the big excitement for me, and again, why I felt pretty comfortable making that prediction, we know where to go. We know what to measure. In general, we have the technology to do it. It's just implementing it. So I think we live in incredibly exciting times. The fact that ever since there's been humans, we've been looking up at the night sky and saying, are we alone? And we live in this generation when we stand a good chance of answering that.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, I don't think any of this is possible without sort of focusing on the integrity being the soul of scientific research. Would you elaborate on your efforts to ensure scientific and engineering integrity at NASA?
You know, like every federal agency, we have a scientific integrity policy that this administration felt very strongly about making sure that every agency has a scientific integrity policy. That's held on actually the webpage of my office. We review that policy annually. Agencies across the federal government have been coming together and exchanging sort of lessons learned and best practices over the years that we've had these scientific integrity policies in place. So it's not just something that, you know, you write a policy and you put it on a shelf. You really have to be constantly looking at it, constantly saying, how are we doing? Because to me, the integrity of the scientific process is key. But what I put even more faith in is the peer review process, because as a scientific community, we have developed an extremely, you know, everybody can criticize it, but it's, to me, it's become an incredibly important part of making sure that the research that gets published, not just in this country, but around the world, is really of the highest caliber. And I would say, as a member of the scientific community, I always take reviewing a paper as being as much as my responsibility as doing my research. The entire scientific community feels that way. You understand that as we can only move science forward if your job as a scientific reviewer of a journal paper is as important as your job as a researcher. And I think that's the underlying integrity that throughout the scientific process is the fact that we have this peer review process that works so well and really keeps the literature, I think, being of extremely high quality so that we can continually be building. You know, as Newton said, you know, if I've seen further, it's because I stand on the shoulder of giants. And we only are able to live in the society we do with the advances in treating disease, the, you know, your phones that now can do amazing things, the fact that we can feed so much of the world. All of this has relied on the fact that we have such a strong scientific process. We have this peer review process. We have science with such high integrity, not just in this country, but as a global community.
So turning to the future, what's in store for the NASA chief scientist? What's in store for your office going forward? How do you see it evolving? And I don't know, is there any emerging technologies that you think are going to advance your efforts?
You know, again, for my office, I think the important thing is to always be providing the administrator with just the most up-to-date critical advice I can on what is the state of science, how can we move it forward, and how can, looking across the agency, how can we always make sure that between all these different things we do, that we're not losing the connections between what we do? Because I think one of the emerging things that we're really seeing is some of the most interesting science, as usual, is taking place at the borders between disciplines, like climatology, for example, which really has to do with how a planet works, but also has to do with astrophysics, going back to this whole issue of where you sit in your distance and how a solar system evolves, which we need to understand that through astrophysics, but then also understanding the complex effects of that are coming from the interior of the planet, hugely complicated. So climatology, astrobiology, the formation of life on the other planets, these are taking places between disciplines. And so I think an office like an office of a chief scientist has to be able to say, what's happening between the cracks? And is that some of the most interesting science moving forward? So that's, I think, going to be increasingly the focus moving forward. Again, going back to the fact, this issue of technology, how can we push satellite technology? How can we push small sats to become more capable? Because the more we can bring costs down, the more we can do. And then finally, the third thing is really this issue of partnerships. And when you bring together science and technology and you create innovative partnerships with private sector, with your international partners, again, you're just going to get more science. You're going to get more bang for your taxpayer buck.
Great. So what advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in public service or the sciences?
You know, to me, there's no greater career than I can think of than the one I've done, which is how can I help move this nation's science enterprise forward? We're doing amazing things across this government, whether it's NOAA making us have the most up-to-date weather forecasts, whether it's the work we do at the U.S. Geological Survey, the Department of the Interior, trying to understand how this nation's waterways, how our the geology of this country and how it works. You know, the Coast Guard, all the different federal agencies that I touch, whether it's working on the oceans, working on the Arctic, you know, I see the incredible dedication of the civil servants across this federal government. And so I always tell everybody, you want a great career where you work hard on the tough problems, come work for the federal government.
Ellen, thanks for your time today. But more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Thank you.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with Dr. Ellen Stofan, NASA's chief scientist. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.